From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump said today he will visit Puerto Rico next week as the U.S. territory continues to deal with the aftermath of Hurricane Maria. Much of the island remains without water and power, and food is scarce. Joining us now is an aid worker there, Michael Fernandez, who is executive director of CARAS, a nonprofit based in Puerto Rico. He's in Cataño, just southwest of San Juan. Michael, tell us about what it's like there right now.
The situation is a little bit complicated, mainly because the logistics have not been able to be established between mainly the government and all of the aid that's trying to reach the several towns. We have a major issue with telecommunications, even within the government, but also the roads are not open, so it's very difficult to bring supplies. So, for example, we know of several shelters in the center and in the west of the island that have been without food and water for a couple of days or not enough to satisfy all the people who are in these shelters. Thousands of people lost their homes, so they don't have another place to go except the shelters. We have, although the local companies are working with it, there's an issue with the distribution of gasoline and diesel, and that inhibits the local government to be able to operate its machinery to open some of the roads or even to supply for the generators. So we know of several buildings, for example, that where the elderly live in retirement homes, and there are 15, 20 stories high, and there's no electricity for several days. There is no water. These people cannot come down from the buildings. There is disease, also lice, conjunctivitis spreading amongst several people. So, you know, right now it's very complicated. A lot of the flooding has still not gone down. So it's difficult also to actually reach some of the people in their houses. I mean, Cataño now, the flooding, you know, it's been 5 days, and there's one of the communities is still flooded with very black water, and we see the people already having rash. I have a rash from having gone in and helping some of the people in the community. So it's complicated. And also, we have deforestation, and we're worried about the rains that are coming and the capacity for our forests to hold that water. And if they can't, then we're going to see more flooding.
But what you're also saying, it sounds like, is that there are supplies on the island. You just can't get them to the places where they need to go.
That's one of the issues. And, you know, they're saying that there are enough supplies, but you go to the supermarkets and they don't all have supplies. And the farther away you get from the capital and from the main port, the less supplies you see. So, you know, it's hard to tell exactly if we are lacking supplies or is that they're not being able to be distributed. But it's going to look like we're going to need more supplies. Especially to be able to attend all the people who are in the shelters. We got even our hospitals right now. The other day, one of the hospitals asked volunteers to come and help transport patients into another hospital because they had run out of diesel and they couldn't operate their generator. So it's just a series of things that are interconnected that are making the day-to-day life complicated.
I was speaking with a friend in Florida whose family is in Puerto Rico, and he said they have no water and they've been drinking out of a stream. Is that something that you're hearing about as well?
There isn't water. Now the military, the United States military, was able to bring some generators to power some of the water pumps. So a little bit over 20% of the population has water. But that's only the people who live close to the metropolitan area. Everybody else is without water. And because we can't get the water to the people, they have to resort to drinking from the streams, which is not recommended right now either because we have an issue of contamination in the water. And just runoff that's coming in from the mountains, right, makes the water not be filtered. So it's just a complicated situation.
President Trump spent many days not saying anything about Puerto Rico, but he did tweet about it last night, and he said, Puerto Rico, which was already suffering from broken infrastructure and massive debt, is in deep trouble. Its old electrical grid, which was in terrible shape, was devastated. Much of the island was destroyed with billions of dollars owed to Wall Street. And the banks, which sadly must be dealt with, food, water, and medical are top priorities and doing well. What do you make of that tweet from President Trump? And is it true that food, water, and medical are top priorities and doing well?
They may be a top priority, but I don't know that they're doing well. And we do have that's one of the biggest complications. Our economy failed and we're bankrupt. And Congress had to pass a special legislation to fiscalize all of the operations of the government. Now we have to tap into a relief fund that supposedly we have enough money to contribute to the situation. It's about $1 billion, but we know it's going to cost way more. And I'm sure that the bondholders are putting pressure on congressmen and on the president to make sure that they see their money. But, you know, we have lives to worry about right now. And that has to be our number one priority and nothing else.
That's Michael Fernandez, who is executive director of CARAS, a nonprofit based in Puerto Rico. Michael, thank you so much for doing what you're doing and for sharing that information with our audience. It's so important that people hear what's going on right now in Puerto Rico. So thank you.
Thank you.
And as Michael just told us, Hurricane Maria destroyed much of the communication infrastructure connecting Puerto Rico, the U.S. territory, with the rest of the world, including the millions of Puerto Ricans living on mainland America. Tim Padgett from member station WLRN reports that those in Miami are doing all they can to reconnect with family and friends on the island.
Hay alguien que tenga información del sector La Sabana en Cedro Bajo.
For many Puerto Ricans in the U.S., this is one of the only means of communicating with people back in Puerto Rico at the moment. It's Zello, the walkie-talkie app that transmits messages on group channels when cell phone service is a challenge, as it is right now in Puerto Rico. It's been a week since Hurricane Maria ravaged the Caribbean island. At least 10 people died in the storm. Maria knocked out power, water, and communications island-wide, as South Florida Puerto Ricans like Jesus Figueroa are all too aware.
Well, the problem is that most of the communication towers, they're in place, but they're not connected to the grid. They're working on generators, and since they have a lot of landslides, right now it's hard to get into the stations to put the fuel on them.
Figueroa works for the federal government. He left Puerto Rico 15 years ago to live in Miami. His native island has suffered hurricanes before, but he says this is the first time he's ever known it to be so utterly cut off from the world. On Sunday, Figueroa stood outside his church in Palmetto Bay listening to Zello transmissions and hoping to hear any word about his relatives in the central Puerto Rican city of Naranjito.
It's very frustrating because you don't know if they're good, if they've been hurt or not, or if they need something. You're not able to communicate with them.
Hurricane Maria is one of the worst natural disasters to hit Puerto Rico in almost a century, and it will probably take years to recover. Puerto Ricans on the island are U.S. citizens, but right now they're feeling more like neighboring Haiti did last year after being leveled by Hurricane Matthew, less protected by U.S. infrastructure. What little information the more than 1 million Puerto Ricans here in Florida have been able to glean has been alarming. Ana Maria Moran is a retiree in West Palm Beach. She finally heard from relatives back in her flooded coastal hometown of Manatee over the weekend.
Maybe 20, 30 seconds. They were able to get some signal and to call us. Everybody is in the same situation. Food and water left for only a few days. No fuel, no communications with authorities. A tearful call because the hospital is collapsing.
Moran is a former international aid worker. Her son's a pilot. Now that she knows the situation, they're set to make a relief flight to Manatee this week to deliver supplies. They also hope to bring locals with urgent needs back to Florida.
The plane will fit 10 people, moms with their babies and the elderly. Some of them are isolated. You can't get to them at this point.
But very few here have been as fortunate as Moran to speak with loved ones on the island. That's why Puerto Rico hurricane networks are popping up on social media. They're like bulletin boards where Puerto Ricans here can get information about people there, and vice versa.
Those that have communication with somebody in the island, then we say, oh, can you please check for this person, and call me back.
One of those bulletin boards was set up by a South Florida networking group called Boricuas Realengos, or Far-Flung Puerto Ricans. Angie Flores of Miramar heads Boricuas Realengos.
Can you check my cousins because I cannot communicate with them? And then they call you, even though they don't know you, they pass the information.
Flores herself has yet to make contact with relatives in her hometown of Juncos, southeast of Puerto Rico's capital, San Juan. A flooded river has submerged much of Juncos. For people on the island, the communications breakdown is even scarier. WLRN made contact with San Juan attorney Francisco Gonzalez. He had just made it to the rural town of Caguas to check on friends, and he called the devastation and isolation extraordinary.
Over 70% of the electrical poles are down. Most of the roads could not be used because we have lost, I will say, 80-85% of all the trees around the roads.
But Gonzalez did have one piece of personal good news.
We have been able to communicate with my daughter that lives in Tampa.
Even before Hurricane Maria, Puerto Rico was suffering one of the worst economic crises in its history, as well as a massive exodus to the U.S. mainland. Gonzalez said he fears the hurricane will only drive more Puerto Ricans away. For Here and Now, I'm Tim Padgett in Miami.
President Trump is being criticized for not responding more quickly to the crisis in Puerto Rico. New York Congresswoman Nydia Velazquez said this could turn into Trump's Katrina. But this morning, in a brief press exchange, the president said food and water was being delivered on an hourly basis.
We've worked very, very hard in Puerto Rico. It's very tough because it's an island. In Texas, we can ship the trucks right out there and, you know, we can do, we've gotten A pluses on Texas and on Florida. And we will also on Puerto Rico. But the difference is this is an island sitting in the middle of an ocean. And it's a big ocean. It's a very big ocean.
And on Twitter this morning, the president returned to the topic of football, calling on the NFL to simply ban kneeling during the national anthem after his friend, Dallas Cowboy owner Jerry Jones, knelt with his entire team before standing and locking arms during the anthem. Tamara Keith covers the White House for NPR. Hi, Tam.
Hi, how's it going?
Oh, good. But to the president's remarks on Puerto Rico first. Last Sunday, Hillary Clinton called on him and the Defense Department, send the Navy, you know, the USNS Comfort Ship. There's a change.org petition for sending this medical ship. You know, it's been almost a week. Yes, it's a big ocean, but we have a big Navy. We have an Air Force that could drop things. What's the sense here?
The sense is that they are working on it, that this is a pretty unprecedented thing that has happened to Puerto Rico. It's an island where 3.5 million Americans don't have power, where water conditions are problematic in some areas. And yesterday, the head of FEMA, as well as the president's Homeland Security advisor, were both on the ground in Puerto Rico assessing what needs to be done. The president today says that they are on it. Certainly, FEMA has put out a list of things that it is doing and has been doing, but this is of massive proportions.
Right. Well, of course, his many critics are asking why, just in his support, why so much time on the NFL kneeling issue when an island of Americans is in trouble? Let's take that up. What do you think of the theory that President Trump made the comment about the NFL during a rally for Alabama Senator Luther Strange ahead of today's election, because Trump's core supporters in Alabama actually support Strange's opponent, Roy Moore. And according to people like Maggie Haberman and Glenn Thrush in The Times today, President Trump is unhappy with his political team for getting him to back Strange instead of Moore, the one his supporters back. So he threw some red meat to the base in Alabama with the NFL comment.
So there have been differing reports about why and how President Trump came to endorse Luther Strange. There is a sense, certainly from the way Strange talks about Trump and how Trump has talked about Strange, that they have a personal relationship, that they have a friendship, that Luther Strange has been loyal to President Trump, and President Trump does prize loyalty. However, he was at a rally in Alabama, a state that he loves because that state loves him. And he brought up this thing that he has actually brought up before about the kneeling in the NFL. He was talking about it shortly before the election last year. And he got a response. There was this strong response from this crowd of people in Alabama. Then there was a strong media response.
Right.
And then President Trump saw an opportunity, as he has with many of these other feuds that he has picked before, where he sees an opportunity to feed his base at a time where he made a deal with a Democrat, with Democrats. That's not something that, you know, necessarily helps him with his base. He said he would be willing to put off building the wall. He did some things recently that could make his base and had made his base kind of unhappy. And if you're talking about the NFL, if you're having a culture war fight, you're not talking about how the healthcare bill right. is kind of crashing and burning.
Right. Well, but what about the race aspect? You know, his many critics say why he has supporters, as you point out. But his critics say why so critical of black football players, but not of white supremacists. You know, some of them are fine people, or even Vladimir Putin. You know, the president said it's not about race. Is this going to bite him or no?
I don't know. Did his fight with the Gold Star father, Keyser Khan, bite him? Mm-hmm. This is sort of an ongoing pattern for President Trump, and he sees it as an opportunity. He sees it as working for him. Now, of course, he is doing things and saying things that even, you know, someone like Tom Brady, the quarterback of the Patriots, who is a supporter of President Trump's, said is divisive language.
Well, we will see how that plays out. Real quick, Tamara, your sense of the Trump White House, General Kelly was supposed to stabilize it. Now we've got the NFL blow up. Your sense?
General Kelly never said he was there to control the president. He was there to be the chief of staff, not the chief of the president. However, Kelly did put out a statement saying that he believes people should stand during the national anthem.
Tamara Keith, White House correspondent for NPR. Tam, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
And now a quick snapshot on medical marijuana. 29 states now allow patients to use it for medicinal purposes, including senior citizens. But there are many obstacles, ranging from finding a doctor who's licensed to prescribe it to paying for it. In New York, considered an especially restrictive medical marijuana state, reporter Karen Michelle looked at some of the benefits and difficulties for seniors seeking legal marijuana.
Larry Yokelson uses a walker and is on oxygen 24/7.
I'm not a pothead.
Though 87-year-old Yokelson was familiar with the stuff, between the 70s and the mid-90s, he'd been a driver for rock bands.
You want to know something? Led Zeppelin, Paul McCartney, I can't even tell you the list.
Yokelson says that just about all of his passengers smoked pot, but he didn't like it. More recently, he didn't like the opioids he'd been prescribed for his constant back pain either.
You name it, and I've been on it, and it's... You become so constipated from opiates, you want to kill yourself. That's how bad it is.
He told his daughter Jan he was ready to give up.
He said he was done. Put me in hospice. I'm done. I can't live like this.
But he found a sympathetic doctor.
He gave me a prescription, and I was in agony up to that point. So I took it at night, and I woke up in the morning, and I said to everybody in the house, I'm pain-free in one dose. Medical marijuana to me is a miracle, and it actually saved my life.
Larry Yokelson takes a tincture of medical marijuana under his tongue at night and a capsule during the day. In New York, it's not even possible to get something to smoke or eat. At his age, Yokelson is part of the fastest-growing group of medical marijuana users, old folks, as found in a recent study at New York University.
This has been a really understudied issue.
Geriatrician Benjamin Hahn was the lead researcher.
Previous generations have had very low prevalence of using drugs and alcohol, but with the baby boomer generation, this is really going to change dramatically.
Hahn's not using hyperbole here. In a sample of 47,000 people aged 65 and older, the prevalence of using marijuana, whether medically or recreationally, showed about a 250% increase between 2012 and 2013. For his study on seniors and medical marijuana, the University of Iowa's Brian Caskey found that state program directors reported a huge increase in applications from folks over 60.
I've been in states from Washington, Colorado, Minnesota, Vermont, Maryland, Illinois, Missouri, we've been all over. And in those focus groups in which there were persons who had medical cannabis, the stories were just amazing.
Caskey found the stories from what he calls the more interesting bunch were the folks like Larry Yokelson, with an aversion to marijuana, especially to smoking it. But medical marijuana comes in many forms.
You can take it as a pill or edible form. You could rub it on your skin lesions. That's what I saw one person with cancer doing, and it provided relief for them. And that just is what really struck me. It's like, wow, there's a whole population of older persons out there who actually see this as a medical benefit.
Caskey notes that marijuana, by federal law, is a Schedule I drug, along with heroin, making its acceptance more of a challenge for potential patients and their providers.
Because they don't want the liability associated with dispensing something that hasn't been approved by the federal government.
Each state has its own medical marijuana regulations, New York among the most restrictive. Columbia Care has dispensaries in several states, including New York. Columbia Care's dispensary in New York City is on a major busy street that's considered the dividing line between up and downtown. There's a guard in front checking patient ID, a card much like a driver's license, and inside a friendly receptionist and comfy seating. According to Columbia Care's CEO, Nicholas Vita, in New York State, the average age of a patient is 54.
I think that the sort of the aging population is actually one of the fastest growing markets nationally for medical marijuana products. And our view is that the products we manufacture really should be designed to separate themselves from the counterculture sort of history of marijuana and focus on the medicinal application and the benefits.
Studies and experience have shown there are many conditions of the aged, including neuropathy, lack of appetite, pain, and difficulty sleeping, that are especially responsive to treatment with medical marijuana. But there are many barriers to access beyond any legal concerns. Again, Larry Yokelson.
Medicaid, Medicare does not pay for a reimbursement. So it's a very tough thing for the aging population to go through.
He relies on his daughter to drive 45 minutes to get it for him. But recently, several dispensaries started offering home delivery, and dispensaries in New York and elsewhere now offer video consultations. But it all comes at a price. For Here and Now, I'm Karen Michelle.
When you buy something as expensive as a mattress online, how do you judge its quality? Well, you might rely on reviews. But what if those reviews are being paid for by a mattress company? That's exactly what was happening with Casper, which started in 2013. Now it's worth about $750 million and is in partnership with the retail giant Target. Joining us now with more on this is our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Jason Del Rey is senior editor at Recode. He joins us from New York. Hi, Jason.
Hey, Jeremy.
And let's go back to the beginning of this story. Casper's competitors were paying commissions to people to write bad reviews of Casper mattresses.
Well, that's essentially the allegation Casper had when it sued three of these sites. All of these sites make money by getting commissions from the brands that they recommend. If the commission is the same across the board, perhaps you could think they have, you know, there's no intention to recommend one over the other. But Casper claimed that these sites would write Casper reviews, get them to turn up high in Google search results, and then recommend competing mattresses over Casper. And the allegation is that these other companies were paying more than Casper was ever willing to, and essentially auctioning off Casper's search traffic.
So Casper sued and ended up settling with these companies, right?
This is true. Two of the three fought the suits at first, but then eventually settled. And the last one ended up selling their company to another review site company that Casper is now financing.
Yeah, so explain that. The twist here is that Casper basically was angry about what was going on before and then sort of said, if you can't beat them, join them, and bought.
They financed the takeover of this review site, Sleepopolis. They gave a loan to this company that owns other sites like Mattress Clarity. That's the name of another review site. And so Casper now says they have no control over the site. They're not operating it themselves. But there's this financial link which just makes things really, really messy. Just even if they have disclosures on the site, which they do, you know, the whole industry now is gossiping about what this means when some of the most popular review sites are now connected
right
to Casper.
So for our listeners who are hearing this and maybe they're in the market for a mattress, what can they do to make sure that they're getting an independent reviewer? Is it even possible anymore when you want to buy something like a mattress online?
I mean, I would it's really tough. The best thing to do is, you know, well, a couple of things. Let me back up. Amazon reviews, you know, Amazon at least verifies that the person who is reviewing something and has purchased that item. Now, there's ways to get around that, and it's still not always, you know, clear how accurate and real those are, but there's some verification. The other thing is a lot of these online mattress companies let you try them out for 100 days. I did that with a Casper mattress, returned it. It was an easy process. Some other brands I've heard make it a little harder to return. So there's no simple answer, unfortunately.
That's Jason Del Rey, a senior editor at Recode. Jason, thank you.
Thanks.
For centuries, tracking animals was as impractical as it was imprecise. Look, a feather, some droppings, paw prints. But now, thanks to satellites, drones, GPS collars, DNA sequencing, we know where the animals go, which is the title of a new book by James Cheshire and Oliver Uberti. James, a senior lecturer at the University College London, where he's also a cartographer. Welcome.
Hello.
And Oliver is a former design editor for National Geographic. Oliver Uberti, welcome to you as well.
Thanks for having us.
And the fact that you're cartographers and design editors is why this book is so beautiful. James, start with you. Why?
We're at a time, really, where there's an animal tracking revolution that's just started. And our skills really are taking these big, complicated data sets that the tags and sensors are sending back and producing these beautiful maps and graphics from them.
Well, and you quote a turtle researcher, Oliver, you both do, who said, in order to protect animals, you need to protect where they go.
Tracking allows us to see what we can't observe for ourselves. It's the nocturnal wanderings of a jaguar or the seasonal migrations of a bird. And if you only protect, say, the breeding grounds of a golden-winged warbler in Tennessee, but you aren't putting in place protections or working with other countries to put in protections in their wintering grounds in the tropics, that's only half the story.
Right.
And we tried to show you the full story.
It's very clever because you have kind of put on some of these animals human characteristics, like elephants who text and, you know, jaguars who take selfies. They don't really. They're just involved. They're interacting with this technology. But let's address the pheasants who walk the Himalayas. As you say, search for tragopan mating dance on YouTube, and you will see why they are named after Pan, the promiscuous Greek god of the wild. Tell me a little bit about these pheasants.
Their migrations and their mating dance are two separate stories.
But I know, but the mating dance is so much fun.
The mating dance, I really encourage your listeners to check it out. And it turns out their migration behaviors are equally surprising. There's a temptation to think, when we think about climate change, that as temperatures rise, that animals, especially that live in alpine environments, will kind of get painted into a corner. And the researchers who tagged these tragopans were surprised to find that within their small sample size, they had tragopans that were going down to lower elevations in the winter, but they also had a few that went uphill in the winter. And when they're living in the Himalayas, that's a feat in itself.
I mean, I think the moral of that story is that no two animals are the same, really, and we're interested in how individuals behave. And it's optimistic in many ways because it shows that animals might be more resilient to some of the changes that in climate that we can expect, but also, it does really underscore that we're dealing with quite complex systems in a way, and we need to be really careful and really value the way that we manage them and interact with them.
Well, and you said something about a surprise, Oliver. Researchers have been shocked at the wide range of some of the animals. For instance, jaguars.
First of all, jaguars are hard to find. They are living in the rainforest. They evolve to be elusive. They're nocturnal. So one of the methods that researchers have implemented to try and see the jaguars is to use camera traps. And they would set up camera trap grids 60 square kilometers around the size of Manhattan. This researcher, Matthias Tobler at San Diego Zoo Global, started to realize as their ranges were 10 times the size of Manhattan. Mm. It's kind of like that line from Jaws, we need a bigger grid, right? Mm-hmm. So he went back out and set up a camera trap grid 650 square kilometers. And that's what we show in the book. All the sightings, not only of jaguars, but all the other animals in the rainforest that jaguars interact with.
Yeah. Terns also a much wider range than people thought, James?
Yeah, that was another real surprise that researchers have known and ornithologists have known that Arctic terns, who are the quite small birds, do these tremendous migrations from essentially the northern hemisphere to the southern hemisphere. But what they didn't anticipate was the kind of detours they took en route. So these particular groups of terns came from the Netherlands. They flew to the coast into the Southern Ocean, and then they went along as far as Australia and New Zealand before looping back and flying back along Antarctica and back up to the Netherlands. And if you're damaging the ecosystems at any part of that journey, you would be damaging the prospects of the migrating bird.
And you're talking about a journey here that in total is 70, 90,000 kilometers, depending on where the bird originated from.
And by the way, how do we know how far terns fly?
They were given these tiny sensors that were strapped to their legs, and there are these really clever systems that look at the number of hours of daylight. Because the terns are small and the journeys are so great and so long, you need a tiny tag that lasts a long time, and that's exactly what these ones do.
Another thing that has made news quite a bit is the journey of the mountain lion, and one in particular. P-22 is one of them, and M-86?
P-22 we hear a lot about. He's definitely in Hollywood what you'd call an A-lister. He's from a population originally from the Santa Monica Mountains, marooned on a genetic island, and they need to be able to get out and diversify their gene pool. But the freeways of Southern California make that nearly impossible. And plans are in the works to develop a vegetated bridge across the 101 to give the Santa Monica Mountain lions a chance. But few people are talking about another population from the Santa Ana Mountains on the way to San Diego. They really need a vegetated land bridge somewhere along Interstate 15, which is about 8 to 10 lanes. And if they can get across that, they have a nearly unbroken chain of wilderness all the way down towards Mexico. It's really their only hope. And we've underestimated the significance of freeways as a barrier. I had the pleasure of going to Kenya and working with Ian Douglas Hamilton and Frank Pope of Save the Elephants. I joined them on an elephant coloring operation in Tsavo National Park. Now, the situation in Tsavo is they've recently built a high-speed railway that goes from the capital, Nairobi, to the port of Mombasa on the coast. And that railway bisects Tsavo National Park, and it's bisecting elephant migration corridors. But they were able to lobby the construction company to build underpasses at strategic points along the railway to allow the elephants to move back and forth and continue their migrations. And now they're doing everything. They've got a wildlife tracking app, and they partner with Google Earth, and they're doing a lot of different things to allow them to have real-time updates of where the elephants are while they're doing their aerial survey.
You actually went to this elephant culling and saw this elephant because this elephant had been shot and was down.
The accelerometers in these collars allow, say, the elephants to monitor the rate of movement of an animal. So if an animal is shot or injured, it will start moving more slowly and it will drop below a threshold. And when that threshold is broken, an automatic text message is sent out. So I was in the airplane with Frank Poe from Save the Elephants. We're flying back from the collaring operation in Tsavo National Park, and his phone lights up with a text message that says, "Culling's been moving unusually slowly." And it turned out she'd been shot four times by herders who were competing for resources.
Well, here is a moment where you were right by this incredible beast. She did die. And, I'm reading along thinking, wow, there's this great technology, so of course they're going to save the elephant. And it doesn't happen. But what still is the benefit there of the technology?
I think that one of the biggest benefits and actually one of the most transformational things about, personally for me doing this book, and I think for the readers, is you do start to look at animals as individuals and you can relate to them. They have day-to-day challenges that they have to overcome. And I think being able to watch on a map the journey of an animal that's suffering, or even just the journey of an animal that is thriving, it really does bring the data to life, and it helps educate people, I think, about what it is we can do to live more harmoniously with them.
Well, because, as you see, it's laid out here. This is one of your graphs. Morning commute. 46 baboons begin their daily forage with a river dash, and we see it. Couple last things. Sea turtles and pythons have internal compasses that help them navigate.
It's not just having a compass, it's having a timetable. One of the favorite stories for me is the story of a turtle named Fisher, who was rescued as a baby turtle, spent his life in an aquarium, was released, and made straight lines straight to the part of the ocean it needed to be in with all the other turtles of a similar age. It was just some innate feeling that he needed to be in this part of the ocean at this particular part of his life.
It's one of the great mysteries of animal migration. And, you know, the scientists, we're learning new things all the time. It's tempting to think in 2017 we know everything about the natural world. But if there's one thing we try and make clear about this book is that the scientists were being surprised all the time.
Yeah. And someday, maybe we just tap into what they're already doing. The book is Where the Animals Go, Tracking Wildlife with Technology in 50 Maps and Graphics. And they are beautiful because James Cheshire is a cartographer, Oliver Uberti, a former design editor at National Geographic. They've put this book together. We'll have pictures at hereandnow.org. Thank you both so much.
Thank you for having us.
Kurds in northern Iraq are celebrating after yesterday's independence vote, but their neighbors are reacting with anger and threats. The U.S. also isn't pleased. The State Department called the decision to hold the controversial vote deeply disappointing. Joining us now from Erbil in northern Iraq in the Kurdish part of the country is NPR's Jane Arraf. Jane, the results aren't official yet, but if the Kurds did vote for independence, what does that actually mean?
Well, it seems pretty clear there actually was a resounding yes, because almost every Kurd that any of us have talked to have said that they would vote yes even if they didn't agree with the timing of this. So it's expected to be overwhelmingly a yes vote, and it doesn't have clear implications. It's not binding, but what it does do, what the Kurdish government intends it to do, is give them a mandate so that they can go to Iraq and say, look, our people overwhelmingly want independence. And they also intend to say, more controversially, people in the disputed territories now controlled by Kurdish forces also want independence. So nothing binding, but really it's a mandate.
And let's talk about the reaction to it, starting with Turkey. What are they saying?
They are hugely upset, as are all of Iraq's neighbors. And I guess part of the reason why they're so upset is they all warned the Kurdistan region not to do this. So the fact that it went ahead and did it anyway sort of speaks volumes. Now, the Kurdish president Masoud Barzani gave a press conference just the evening before the referendum, and he essentially said he thought that all of this opposition would kind of go away on its own. Well, that remains to be seen. Right now, Turkey is threatening both economic sanctions. It says the Kurds will go hungry. It's threatening military maneuvers. It's doing joint exercises with Iraqi forces along the border. Iran is also doing exercises, and both of them are saying that they might close their borders. But certainly in the case of Turkey, that would hurt Turkey's economy as well.
What about the reaction in Baghdad? What are the Iraqi officials saying about this vote?
They are absolutely furious. So it ranges from Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi, who also warned the Kurds not to go ahead with this, who has said repeatedly since Kurds went out to vote that this is illegal, it's unconstitutional, and he is not going to sit down to negotiate. He says that's just not going to happen. And then it goes into Iraqi parliament, and parliament has passed a vote that calls for all sorts of measures, all the way from firing civil servants who voted to sending troops to the border regions to closing its own de facto borders, all sorts of measures in there. But again, that may just be talk. And just because the Iraqi parliament says it wants to do something certainly doesn't mean that it gets done.
And we mentioned the U.S. response, the State Department deeply disappointed, but it also said the historic relationship between the U.S. and the Kurds won't change. Right now, that relationship includes the Kurds playing a major role in the fight against ISIS. Does this vote threaten that alliance?
Well, on the surface, it does threaten the alliance, because one of the cornerstones of U.S. policy has been that Iraq remains intact. It has made that clear ever since it toppled Saddam Hussein in 2003. But the fact is that the Peshmerga, the Kurdish fighters, and the Kurdistan government here are key partners with the U.S. in this fight against ISIS. It was Kurdish troops that stood up to ISIS in a lot of places along the in northern Iraq when the Iraqi army melted away. Now, the Iraqi army was reconstituted in a sense, and they have come back and they've fought and they have suffered a lot of losses and they have driven ISIS out. But in those early days when ISIS was a serious threat, it was purely Kurdish forces that were fighting them in a lot of places. So this isn't expected to permanently alter that alliance, but it does complicate things. And part of the reason that the U.S. is so concerned is it feels that as this dispute develops between Baghdad and Erbil, that also diverts attention away from fighting ISIS. The other reason, very quickly, is that the Kurds are basically laying claim to a lot of territory that was previously part of central Iraq. One of the most important of those is Kirkuk, which is in the middle of the northern oil fields.
And by the way, you're joining us today from Erbil in the Kurdish region. Obviously, today the news is happening there. But often when we speak with Western reporters in Iraq, that's where they are because it's by far the safest part of the country for a Westerner to be in, correct?
Yes. And if I hesitate, it's only because it's also the most comfortable part of the country to be in. Let's be honest about that. It's more welcoming in many ways to journalists than Baghdad is, but Baghdad itself is not perhaps as dangerous as a lot of people think. It is still dangerous, let's be clear about that. But yes, what the Kurds have created here is quite remarkable. They have taken control of this territory. They've had a semi-autonomous state for years, and they have turned it into probably the most prosperous and most stable part of Iraq. That is indisputable.
That's NPR's Jane Arraf in Erbil in northern Iraq. Jane, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.